Those showers will get temperatures here at around about 7 or 8 degrees. That's your forecast.
Many thanks, Nina. Now, Darling Monster concludes. Letters written from Lady Diana Cooper to her son, John Julius Norwich, who introduces some of that correspondence. In the early 50s, his mother's social whirl embraces the Duke and Duchess of Windsor, Truman Capote, Princess Margaret, Graham Greene, and General Eisenhower. The letters are read by Patricia Hodge.
Beloved, be faithful. Beloved, be true.
On the boat to Folkestone, May the 13th, 1949. Darling Monster. Last night, Papa and I dined with the Duke and Duchess of Windsor. The company was far from distinguished, but the appointments, my dear, the appointments, she's dolled the gloomy house up wonderfully. Wallace herself in fine repair, dressed in what might be the stiffest Persian black and gold caftan, with springing skirt off the floor and plain oriental neckline, and some very fine diamonds, worn negligently. The Duke looked his withered self, and never made head or tail of anything I said. The stairs were flower-lined, rather commonly, as for a wedding. The dining room entirely candle-lit, footmen in royal scarlet, the faithful Caribbean manservant in the same livery. The table had so much upon it that I got bewildered, flowers and candles and boxes for toothpicks and cruets, of course, and matches individual and cigarettes in gold boxes and five equal-sized knives, ditto forks, in white Dresden china. I had to ask which to take for what, and further blotted my copybook by using my side plate as an ashtray instead of a gold dish. The Duchess had to reprove me.
My mother had wangled an invitation to stay with the Duke of Alba, the greatest grandee of Spain. In her words, she'd set him a snare into which he is plopped. She'd asked the Duke if he had any influence with the hotel in Seville, because the rooms were all booked up for Holy Week. As a result, he invited her and my father to stay at his palace.
Seville, April 13th, 1949. We drove here yesterday with the Duke of Alba in a cumbersome Cadillac from Madrid. I sat between him and Papa, who had coughed all night. I'd not slept a wink for sweating, with fear of his death, and consequently diarrhoea. So, the long 10 hours through Castile, the country of Cervantes, through narrow mountains and deeply down into Andalusia, the pause for a good lunch at a government-run inn, the mosque cathedral at Cordova, the courts of the mosque smelling so strongly of orange blossom that one wanted to swoon and become part of the ecstasy. All these things were stained by apprehensions and listening for Papa's breathing and expressions. Why is his mouth slightly open? Isn't one eye more closed than another? Too silly. I like Jimmy Alba. He's of another age, a long past age. He talks like I suppose Spanish grandees spoke in the time of the Catholic kings. For instance, I liked him saying, as we passed some municipal buildings plastered with Patria, Pro Patria, Gloria Patria, etc., ad nauseam, I disapprove of all that. One's life belongs to the king, and one's honour to God only. We arrived here at 7. After dinner, we left in a station wagon and made our way with Jimmy's sister, not Jimmy, and the darkness and some friends through the full moonlit street to the outer wall of the Alcazar, where last night a certain virgin was being processed. The crowd was very gay, no suspicion of religious respect or knees coming into it, but stop-me's of sweets and toys and general relaxation. The procession was a revelation. It takes an endless time to pass, as the huge catafalque which carries the Virgin, dressed in gold and jewels and hardly visible for candles in silver candelabra and silver canopies and treasure of all sorts, has to be carried by 40 or 50 men who cannot see or breathe as they are underneath and covered by the valance. The human tread gives the holy figure a dancing progress, quite different to the effect of wheels. Before her goes, in the same fashion, Christ carrying his cross, or Christ before Pilate, or some other scene of his life, and hundreds of men all carrying candles in very high white sugarloaf hats that turn into masks with slits for eyes, all carrying real candles. There is fortunately no electric light to outshine the mystery. The Virgin's candles are so numerous and bright and big that one's eyes dazzle. I enjoyed it very, very much, but I don't know that 5 days of the same will continue to satisfy. The lower class districts boast of unrestrained crowds. The applause is deafening. The Blessed Virgin might be Hitler or Sinatra. Chantilly, France, June the 8th, 1949. Our Princess Margaret saga. I'm sure she came to show the British ambassador, Oliver Harvey, and his wife her disapproval of their attitude towards us. She'd no other reason. We don't know her. We'd nothing to offer her. At the British hospital, in white-gloved matron's gloomy little den, unenlivened by a bottle of pop and some sponge fingers, she asked me if I lived in France. She was not looking as pretty as I remember her at Buckingham Palace when we lunched there last year, but the eyes and smile give her all she needs, if you are lucky enough to be the one talking to her. I said, "I wish you could have seen where we live. I did leave word at the embassy how welcome you would be, but I don't suppose you heard of the invitation." This last was not said naughtily. I meant, in the general brouhaha, it is natural. "Is it too late?" she said in the Queen's innocent child's voice. I told her, "Of course not, but there is only tomorrow, and it takes almost an hour each way." "May I let you know in the morning?" So little did I think that she meant anything but politeness that the next day I let Papa and our butler Jean go to Paris for lunch. So by 11, when the lady-in-waiting telephoned to say they were coming at tea-time, I was calling up every young man and girl I knew to help and tracking Papa and Jean all over town. Those I caught up with, but no one else was I able to rope in. Just Nancy Mitford, Papa and me, the Princess, and Lady Mary Strachey, her lady-in-waiting, were all that mustered round a board in the picture-room, groaning under strawberries and cream, eclairs, kickshaws, and hot and iced tea for 12. She was commonly but most becomingly dressed as an edible little tart. She'd been dipped into a light, shocking pink dye-pot. Her shoes were black and dainty, her eyes and smile quite breathtaking. She might have been one of our own daughters, gay and talkative, funny, and as attractive as a mother could wish. We made her talk and tell us her journey stories, and good she was about the Pope. "Oh, he was ever so sweet. I was told I must curtsy to him 3 times. I imagined I should have room, but when the door opened, he was right there, and I went donk, donk, donk into his lap." I expect donk is the family word for a curtsy, don't you? I thought it wiser to hurry things on so that she should want to stay, so after tea, I hustled her into the open ford and took her for a tour of the countryside. Then off home she drove, gay and, I'm sure, delighted with the outing. It had the tang of the forbidden. She had clearly been genuinely appreciated by disinterested people. There was fun, and the three hosts were, in a sense, famous. Later, we were told, she said it was what she had most enjoyed in Paris. Next morning, the French were telephoning to say, "Quel triomphe!" The English did not telephone. November the 4th. I lunched in Paris at the best of the Chinese restaurants, superb, with 4 of our friends, and then Truman Capote. They never warned me so as to watch me flinch, but I didn't. A sturdy little pink girl of 14, with her blonde straight hair plastered neatly down all round, short for her age, in rather light grey trousers and turtleneck sweater with feminine curves suggesting through, and lovely little white hands and delicate chain ring and bangles. There you have Truman. That night I had him again. I got quite fond of him, my love of freaks perhaps, and he's anxious to be liked and warm. I'll have to have another go at his incomprehensible book, Other Voices, Other Rooms. Chantilly, January the 24th, 1951. Summoned to Versailles to meet General Eisenhower, here to revisit his headquarters of 1944. I didn't think Ike was a bundle of charms, though he tries to please. He told us of a murder plot during that last German effort in 1944-45, and how his garden was bristling with protecting guns and detectives and hand grenades ready to throw at the assassins. Meanwhile, an unfortunate double was found, a man to stand in for him, to be dolled out in commander-in-chief uniform and medals, and to be driven round in a motor car, followed by armed jeeps to be shot at. What an unpleasant role to be cast with. But he answered my sympathy with, "The double came to see me, and I was horrified what an ugly little fellow they'd chosen to represent me." February 12, 1951. Party yesterday. When Graham Greene arrived, I could see he was in terrible shape. He told me at once that he'd been up till 5 a.m. discussing a play in French adapted from his book The Power and the Glory, with Louis Jouvet, the French actor, and others, and a lot of whiskey. I took him alone to the drinks room to ask what palliatives he needed. Alcohol, he thought. A stiff gin, he hoped, would steady his hand enough to get the glass to his lips without the help of his other one. I suppose the truth is he's a big double drunk, and that's why he looks like Sinclair Lewis, who died a few weeks ago, and as though he had been seared. I can't make out about his faith. I think it's guilty love has put him all out. Hence his book, The Heart of the Matter. Hugo Charteris from the Continental Daily Mail walked with him after lunch and bombarded him with journalist questions such as, "Tell me, Mr. Greene, is The Heart of the Matter autobiographical?" He admitted to Hugo that he would welcome death, but that may have been due to alcoholic depression or desire to be free of Hugo's questions, or again, the only road to repentance. I think Graham is a good man possessed of a devil, and that Evelyn Waugh, contrary to this, is a bad man for whom an angel is struggling. Paris, May 1951. I had an evening of historical honour that needs telling before it's forgotten. I went to dine with the Windsors, alone since Papa was at Ascot. It was a large friendly dinner, Wallace dreadfully overanimated, and I don't somehow think it's drink. Benzedrine, rather. She repeats herself embarrassingly. Evangeline Bruce, the wife of the US ambassador in Paris, was, of course, the loveliest, in a Dior dress of white tulle draped in roses and elegant as a Third Empire picture. She went up in flames after dinner. No one rushed to help with rugs or knocked her down and rolled her in the carpet. She put her own fire out and had to go upstairs to have the charred ends cut out. Meanwhile, the Mexican multimillionaire Charlie Bestegui knocked over a glass with the tail of his coat and broke it resoundingly enough for the Duchess to run across the room and brush the pieces of glass, sticky with stale cocktail, with her white ostrich fan. It was a gesture of grandeur, but the contaminated fan should have been handed over for destruction to the liveried manservant and not kept to coquette with. Later, we all went on to the Monseigneur nightclub, where the Duke looked neither pleased nor shocked, as Wallace sat waving her martini-soaked fan. Chantilly, February 18, 1952. I'm bored, John Julius. Sad, isn't it? This is not a life I could ever tolerate. From early childhood, I was always praying for excitement. Nature provides it in summer, but in winter, the Monday morning stretches out interminably. No garden, no babble or effort. I'd be better in Paris with theatres and concerts and friends, but darling Papa's happy enough and busy with his past delving and his book writing. I have hardly touched my own letters, but I see no hope of making even a small collected volume for friends. Too spiky, too intimate, too obscure because of catchwords and allusions, too sentimental. To expose that side would be a blast on my own trumpet.
Keep watching and waiting till I'm back with you.
Darling Monster was read by Patricia Hodge with John Julius Norwich. The abridgment was by Barry Johnston, and it was a Heavy Entertainment production for BBC Radio 4. Well, we've got the shipping forecast to entertain us in a short while, but before that, sailing by.